Episode 10, Season 3. My name is Klaatu. I will be, as always, your friendly host. Because this is my show. You might be wondering why I haven't released an episode in, like, 3 months, or, well, maybe 3 weeks. It's because I've been moving. I've been having to find a roommate, organize things, unpack some stuff, just really, been pretty busy, and I've also been working on a project, so I have been productive at least, and the project is something that I will talk about in this very episode. It's nothing huge, but it was very time-consuming, took a lot of research, a lot of work, you know, a lot of stuff to do, so I did it, and that's that, so we'll talk about that later. First, we're going to talk about rSync, which is a little application that I love to death. Just can't get enough of it, so I just keep talking about it. And then we'll talk about the little project that I was working on, and maybe some listener feedback or something, and, you know, the usual. rSync, I've talked about this before. In season one, most of my current listeners, I don't believe, were listening to season one. I think there's one that I know of, Digsit. He's the guy who's been around for the whole thing, and that gets him the mention that you just heard. See, I just said his name right on the show. It's so incredible. It's cool. That's what you get when you've been around for 3 seasons of this show. But anyway, seriously, rSync is a cool application. I covered it as a backup application in season one, and that's really what I'm going to be covering again here. But it's simply because a friend of mine was backing up, and suddenly his backup application would not function anymore. And it was essentially because the people who had made the backup application decided to move on to bigger and better things and dropped support of the application. It was not open source or free software of any sort. Well, it was free as in beer. You didn't have to, when you get, you know, he did not pay money for the application, but the code was not open. So he has about, I think, 3 years of backup files that he had been using this little application, you know, as his backup solution. He's got, I think he said, about 3 years of archived backups that are in the format that this application wants to read, and to my knowledge and to his knowledge, nothing else will read. So he's kind of screwed in a way. I mean, not that he's probably going to need a file from 3 years ago, but what's the point, you know, of backing up if every so often your backup application is going to go away and all your archives are going to be rendered useless? There is no point. And this is what prompted me to think yet again of how great free software is, and specifically how great rSync is, because the very next thing I did with him was I sat down, broke open a terminal. He's a Mac user. Broke open a terminal, did a quick, simple, such an easy little shell script, just essentially, you know, rsync-av/volumes/ /tilde/, and then the destination to /volumes/backup drive. And that was basically it. I think an echo done or something like that. And that's it. Dropped the chmodded plus x, the script, and dropped it into a /tilde/bin directory that I made for him, and added that to his path. And I told him, okay, now from now on, all you have to do to back up is go in, type in install backupall.sh, and it will do the rest. Just make sure that your hard drive is plugged in, and it will do everything you need it to do. And so far it's working for him just fine, I'm sure. That's what I use on all of my systems. And it's simple. It's, I hate this word, but it's elegant. It is effective and is going to be around because it's free software. And even if whoever wrote rsync walks away from it tomorrow to make, something bigger and better with more fancy graphics or something, it doesn't matter. rsync will still be there and it can still be supported. Now that's just the rant portion of this. The other side of all this is rsync is a really cool application. It's free software, but it's very and it is very robust and flexible. One of the things that it will do, the dash AV switches, rsync dash AV from source to destination. This is a way to archive and to sync all of your files so that just the new stuff that you've made is being copied over. It's not, it's not you're not copying the whole home directory every single time, or whatever directory it happens to be that you're copying. You're only doing the new stuff, so it's super effective for that. But the other day, interestingly, in IRC, a guy by the name of Lord Drakenblut, Blood, Drakenblood, Drakenblood, he was asking about copy. He had this directory of symlinks that he wanted to copy, but he didn't want to copy them as symlinks. He wanted to copy them as the actual files that the symlinks were pointing toward. And since rsync is one of the man pages that I love to look at, because I'm usually, I'm doing something with it. I knew that I'd seen something about that, so I broke that out open, and sure enough, the dash lowercase l does one thing, dash capital L says to copy symlinks as their referent files. So, meaning that instead of just taking the symlink, it's going to look at what file that symlink is pointing to, and it's going to grab that and copy it. So it's a really cool switch to know, and it turns out that that's also in the just the normal CP command, but rsync's got that as well, so that's cool. Now, one thing that for instance, just the normal CP command does not have, aside from the archiving functions, is the ability to copy over a network. And yeah, SCP can do that, but what if you don't need SCP? You don't need to encrypt the traffic. You can get rid of that overhead by just doing rsync, if it's on your internal network or whatever, just do rsync over a Cat 5 cable, and data moves amazingly fast. It's a very effective way of doing things, and you can just do it over your network, because rather than saying rsync, slash media slash backup drive or slash home slash clatu asterisk to slash media slash backup drive, you can make that, from this IP address to that IP address, just as you would SCP or SSH, but you're doing it with rsync. So, and there's a lot more you can do with it. Like if you break open the man page, you will find all kinds of things. And I know that's really dumb. I mean, obviously you know to break open the man page, but I can't really tell you about everything because I don't know what you want to do. So, and the reason I mentioned the man page, aside, I mean, I know you know that the man page will contain information, but the reason I mentioned specifically the man page of rsync is that it's a really well-written man page. And I've always felt that Unix man pages were, shall we say, obtuse at some times. You go into a man page thinking, I have no idea what this what this program is supposed to do. Let me just read the man page. Man for manual, right? You think of a manual as something that's going to teach you how to use something. Well, not so much with every Unix man page. Sometimes they seem to be more like, well, you're familiar with, the BSD version of this, because you have a white beard and you've been working on Unix forever. So here's some quick tips on our version of it. And that's their man page. And you're just, I mean, that doesn't help you at all. But rsync is a really, really well-written man page. It starts out with a syntax, quite clearly stated. It goes on to some examples, which I love. And then it gets into the nitty-gritty of, okay, here's every switch that you can use, and here's what it does for you. It's a really well-written man page. You should check it out if for two reasons. If you want to use rsync for something, you know, I mean, this is a, it's a really good read. I've literally just sat down and typed in man rsync and just read it through. It's not that long, and it's really cool read. It's just really helpful, and you get a lot of great, you know, you just see all these different switches and what they do, and you're like, ah, cool. You know, and you might not need it right now, but something that you might be able to use later on. You know, someone might mention something in IRC, and you'll be able to just say, oh yeah, rsync does that. I know this from experience now. The second reason is if you are not used to reading man pages that much, you know, I always feel like man pages kind of are an acquired taste, almost, you know? It's like, you know that it contains information, you're just not quite sure how to decipher it all. Well, one of the ways to get into the groove of deciphering man pages is to read a couple of good ones. And, you know, like I say, one of the good ones is rsync. I'm trying to think of another good one. I know there's another one that I really like a lot. I just don't remember. I don't remember which one it is right now. But, you know, I mean, some of the really poorly ones, but poorly written ones, I think. I mean, I remember being perplexed by SSH for the longest time. No idea what it was talking about. Man page, I read it and read it and read it. No earthly clue what they were talking about. It wasn't until I, you know, found a tutorial somewhere that I finally started getting into it. So, there are some good man pages out there. There's some bad man pages out there. And one of the good ones is rsync. So yeah, check out rsync and take a lesson from my friend who, you know, whose backup solution was just not that sturdy. And I know that, I mean, a lot of podcasts will do, you know, a roundup of all the backup applications for Linux. And those are cool, and they're always talking about these, you know, these GUI apps. And we've all seen GUI apps for backing up, and we all have kind of the theory down. You know, you establish a plan and a frequency, and they're all the GUIs are different. They all give you different options, and they're really annoying. And, I mean, I've dealt with way too many of these. You know, every time you get a hard drive, it's got that annoying gold sticker on the front that says includes backup software, and it's always something silly like Retrospect Lite or just some proprietary in-house thing that they came up with. And so you break it open and you go through all the steps and you know what you want to do, but you just don't know how the GUI wants you to do it, so it takes you a lot longer than it ever should. Well, just do it with rsync. You know, not only will rsync be supported forever, it's just so much more simple and so much more direct. And the way that I do it personally is I simply make a shell script with, you know, on each of my computers. I've got a shell script in the /home/bin directory. Well, /home/clat2/bin. In that directory, I have a backup all.sh. And I add that, you know, I add the bin directory to my path, so that I don't even have to think about that. And all it has is, you know, rsync-av --, well, I think it's just /home/clat2, actually, as the source, and then the destination is /media/, you know, whatever it is, USB 1 or something like that, whatever the hard drive location is on that computer. And I will take around a small little USB hard drive that I've got, and on that hard drive I've got a separate directory for each computer. So there's a, you know, Fedora vault, a EEE Debian vault, you know, each computer or each partition of the computer has its own little folder, and that's where I dump all the information that I've got in my home directory over to that, and it syncs it up, and it only copies the new stuff, and it's really effective, and it's fast, and it's very gratifying because you know you're backing up. Now, if you don't think you have the resolve to do that yourself, then you can obviously make it a cron job, and cron jobs are easy to set up. You have to kind of know what your distribution favors. There's like There's a couple of different ways of setting up cron jobs on the system level these days. So I'm not going to really, I won't bother going into that. But if you just, if you go to, like, whatever your distro's main source of information is, go there and look up cron job and find out how they do it. Some of them have, like, this new subsystem that they kind of a layer over the traditional cron job that you just add stuff to this text file and it parses it later. Some of it you just actually put it into the config, you know, like this cron job dot daily, stuff like that. So look into it and find out how your distro does it. It's pretty simple. But you would just set that up to run it however often you want it to run. Make sure that you've got your hard drive plugged in, preferably, and let it go. And I think that's about all I can say about rsync. But boy, do I like that program. It's a good one. Check it out. As I've pointed out, I've been a bit absent lately, but this is mainly because, I've been moving, but also because I have been working on a couple of different projects, some of them Linux-related, some of them, I would say, more artistic projects, but one of the Linux ones that happens to tie into artistic stuff is really working on the notion that Blender, your favorite multimedia app and mine, could be remixed, shall we say, to be a dedicated video editor. Okay, so I don't remember in the past episodes how much I've gone into this, but this is something that I was talking to a couple of people at Ohio Linux Fest about, and it's an interesting theory. And the theory goes something like this. Blender is really, really solid code, right? It's a stable application. It's an attractive application. It's a really, 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 really functional application. They couldn't have done two high-quality animated movies on Blender if it were anything else but those things. Now, the cool thing about Blender, well, the cool thing about free software, is that you can take the code, you can take chunks of it, reuse it, reorder it, whatever you need to do. And one thing that Blender does, as we now know from past episodes, is edit video. And the question, I guess, would be, well, does it edit video well? And while I would say, yes, it does, I would also say not necessarily. For instance, on Linux, Blender is my preferred video editor. But were I to go into an editing suite and set down a computer with Blender on it next to an Avid workstation or a Final Cut Pro workstation, I would be laughed out of the room, and I would probably even be hard-pressed to continue using Blender, simply because getting a job done easily, video editing-wise, not necessarily Blender's forte as it stands. Now, that doesn't mean that Blender can't be, again, remixed, shall we say, into something that would completely compete against Avid and Final Cut and the like of those programs, like Adobe Premiere and Sony Vegas, I think is what their little editor is called. You know, these are fairly professional level video editors, and Blender has the capability, it simply doesn't have the interface. So I've been working on interface design, largely is what I've been doing lately, using GIMP and Inkscape, because that's really all I know how to do. I don't program yet, but I do a bit of graphic design here and there, and I fancy myself as someone who knows a good interface from a bad one. So essentially, this is vaporware until a developer really jumps on it and makes it happen, of course. But I am talking with some developers. If you are in contact with Blender developers, or if you are a Blender developer or could be a Blender developer, let me know for sure, because I would love to talk about this more. I would love to help out any way I can. okay, so, pictures are worth a thousand words, right? So if you go to straightedgelinux.com/videoblender, that's with a lowercase video and a capital B in Blender, so videoblender/specs, that is SPECS, specs, you will see the interface that I have designed. You will find that it is not that different from Blender as is, and that is because Blender as it stands is a very, very, as I've said, functional application. It's not something that needs a complete overhaul. It just needs a lot more of the things that a professional video editor would expect. What does this include? It includes a couple of different things. And I have two different ideas which should work in tandem with one another. So just to be clear, I'm not talking about, for instance, a fork of Blender. That's not what I would call this. I mean, it might technically be. I'm not a programmer, but what I'm really talking about is almost like an alternate version of Blender, or well, like I keep saying, a remix of Blender. The end user wouldn't really have to know one thing from another. I mean, to them, this could look like a brand new application just came out for Linux. To all of us, we would know that, well, in fact, it's just a whole bunch of Blender code with a couple of patches applied to it and a new interface on top of it. So that's what I'm talking about here. And I'm talking about two different versions. I'm talking about something that I'll call Video Blender Pro, which would be the, if you will, Final Cut or Avid for Linux users, and also Video Blender Lite, let's call it. And that would be, if you will, the iMovie or the, I don't really know what else, ULEED video editor or Windows Movie Maker, whatever the applications are out there that do that. And that would be for the hobbyist, for the home user, or for the person who gets overwhelmed by, so many professional options that they don't really need. So let's talk about the consumer version first, because that's probably what a lot of people are interested in, even though I'm more interested in the pro version, but we'll go with the light version, as we'll call it. So oh, actually, you're on straightedgelinux.com, so I changed my mind. Since what you're looking at now is the pro version, I will talk about that first. So some of the features of this would be, well, most notably, it would be a professional video editing environment rather than a 3D modeling environment. It would have screen presets that a video editor would need. So there would be one for rough cutting, which would be the stage of the filmmaking that you're kind of looking through all your scratch footage. So you'd have easy access to your footage, you'd have easy access to being able to see it quickly and kind of pick out the good parts. There'd be a preset for editing, which is what the screenshot would be of. That would be more of the editing workflow where you've got your timeline, your picture, and you've got on the left various controls that you might need to, adjust things about the picture. You could also have a preset for color correction, which would give you easy access to the effects and the color filters. And then I'm thinking maybe like a screening room of sorts, maybe a larger viewer window so that you can kind of see it without a whole bunch of distractions. Maybe a text editor, because Blender does have a text editor in it, so you could make notes while you watch. Pick up the pace here, cut out such and such a frame. Just notes to yourself. It's worth noting too that in this environment, it's very important to have SMPTE time code. Video editors work in something called SMPTE time code, which I won't explain to you because you probably don't care, but the point is that animators, i.e. the people usually using Blender, tend to count in frames, simply from zero to however many frames. That's how they count. This about Blender currently as a video editor really hurts it, because no filmmaker, no video maker is going to be thinking in terms of frames like that. I mean, at a certain point they start thinking in frames, but overall they think in seconds and minutes. So that's kind of a problem with Blender. So in this version we will use SMPTE time code. for the timeline, you know, the counter across. The playhead or the viewer head would have a running tab on what, where in the time code you are. We would have time code being counted in different places throughout the interface so that the video editor knows exactly where they are. And speaking of video, one thing that this would not have, and it's a feature, is video capture. Video capturing is something that a lot of people kind of traditionally associate with video editing, but think about the Unix theory of how to build an application. In Unix, you don't build an application that does everything, right? You build lots of little applications that do one thing, and you string them together. And I think, and I've always felt, that that is the much, much smarter workflow. And I've never really liked it that Avid and Final Cut have that functionality built into them, because it tends to break. It tends to not work correctly. It tends to lag behind the rest of it. So you've got this, you know, you've got an editor that can handle certain things, and yet the capturing portion of it lags behind, and I don't know why that is. I don't know if they just don't like updating how the capture is done. Like, they want you to have to wait till the next version, so you have to purchase it, or what. But it's just a problem. I don't like that, so Blender would not need to worry about that. FFmpeg will import video quite well, so Blender does not need to worry about incorporating that into the interface. And that's that. And also, the thing that Blender, I don't think, needs to worry about trying to incorporate is audio editing. Again, Avid and Final Cut both, and I think it started with Final Cut, they both have a tendency to include a lot of the audio editing capabilities in the program, and you think, oh, well, that's really nice, right? Well, no, it's not nice, because it doesn't work very well, it doesn't render a very smooth or really functional quality of audio, and it tends to always get redone anyway. You know, people spend... A company will have an editor spend way too much time kind of doing a rough audio cut, which is fine, but then they tend to do things like setting levels and setting, you know, inserting fades and all this other stuff, and then they send it over to the sound department and they throw everything out and redo it all. So it's just, it's silly. Silly to have audio in a video editor. Focus, people, focus. Okay, so, a customizable timeline. This is something that would be great to have, your timeline where you've got all your little video regions, the little blue and green bars. Why not let the editor choose what color they have for their regions? And that may sound silly to you, but if you have, you know, five different takes of five different camera setups, suddenly you've got a lot of video happening in one timeline, and you have no, you know, they're all the same color, you have no idea which is which. If you can color code it for yourself, it helps out a lot. So that would be cool. Not very important, but it would be a cool feature for the editor who has a lot of footage to deal with. Screen real estate is always important. A lot of these professional applications, I guess for their marketing or something, they just love to fill up your screen with open windows and just, you know, just all these fancy looking interfaces, and you're just kind of like, how am I supposed to see my picture and where am I supposed to work? So this would be a lot more, I think, conservative in terms of screen real estate. The main key to this, two keys. One is Blender's already flexible interface. You know how you can pull up little drawers and shut them again? That's huge. That's great. We'll keep that. And then the other one is the upper left-hand quadrant, if you're looking at the picture, can be a multi-functioning window. You know, it can have, it can switch just like in Blender. You know, you just, you click on a certain menu and suddenly you are in a file browser. You click on it again and now you're in the node compositing, you know, in a preview window, and just all different effects editor, ISO curve, IPO curves, just, you know, it's really functional like that. And so I think that's a big strength of Blender that other applications really miss out on. I feel like this would be a lot more intuitive as well. than a lot of the pro applications out there, because a lot of the pro applications like to hide all the functionality and keyboard shortcuts or very, very obscure buttons. Whereas I think that our Blender Pro could have, or Video Blender Pro, could have buttons, actually, you know, functional buttons that are easily accessible, that you can somewhat intuitively guess what they do. And we can have keyboard shortcuts assigned to them as well, so that once you get to know it, you're flying through it. But at least, you know, provide the buttons so that we know what kind of features and functions we have available to us. The other thing is an easy way to export. I think if you heard my video tutorial, my Blender tutorial, you know, a couple of episodes ago, you probably saw how easy it was to export the video. It's not really that complex. But if you also kind of think about it, some of the buttons are kind of oddly named. They don't seem to really relate to video so much. So what we could do for this is kind of focus it towards just knowing that it's a video editor here wanting to export and not someone doing 3D animation. I kind of envision all of this being able to tie into the 3D animation program really, really well. You know, maybe being able to, you know, if you've got a movie that you're editing that does incorporate, you know, the video and the 3D stuff, I think the traditional method to do it, to work with that, would be to take that footage over to the real Blender 3D, and do your composite there, and then import those clips of the composited shots into your edit. So that in my mind is as much interfacing or cross interfacing we would ever have to do. But if anyone else has a better idea on that, I'm totally open to hearing how it could be done. That withstanding, the whole, like, if you're following what I'm saying, the Final Cut and motion integration should be avoided, because when you're working in Final Cut and you know, the theory is that you can just open up a motion project and suddenly you've got motion in Final Cut, and it's terrible, terrible performance, terrible idea. It's something that they clearly did just because they wanted to be able to sit at some technical conference and show it off with their, you know, 24-core Mac Pro that no one has except them, and they're doing it with low-resolution video anyway, so that it all looks very fast. And the minute you do something in the real world, it's ridiculous. So, won't be doing something like that. So take a look at the link, the straightedgelinux.com/videoblender/specs link, and take a look at the screenshot that I came up with. And then at the bottom of that page, there's a link to the more home video editor audience. This would be the Video Blender Lite application. And what we see here is, on the left, you see the video preview window, which will also double as a file browser. And that would be where you would preview your clip, kind of see what you've got in, you know, you've got your kid, and the kid is on the merry-go-round, and then 3 minutes into it, he falls off. So you want to cut before he falls off, you know, make him look like he's a really cool kid and everything. So you put a splice right there, and then you drag that down into your timeline, and that's how video editing is done. It's pretty simple, and that's what you can do. Then on the right, you see the movie as it's coming together, and then under that, you see the timeline. So those are all the video and audio clips. Now, the cool thing about this, I think, is that the timeline can be as simple or complex as the editor wants. You know, if you're someone who just has some footage of a family get-together and you just want to cut out some stuff because it's boring, you can do that, and it can just be one strip of video and audio after one strip of video and audio, just kind of back-to-back, and that's it. Maybe some fades, you know, here and there. If you're more of an aspiring movie maker as such, and you have footage that you have story that you want to tell, you might want to start getting a little bit more creative and having different layers and things like that. And, you know, the flexibility of this interface would let you do that, whereas a lot of the simple programs don't let you really don't let you ever go any higher than, a certain level, because they want to upsell you, obviously. They want to sell you, the pro version if you want to do anything too fancy. We wouldn't have that restraint here. And then at the very bottom of the interface, I thought that it might be a good idea to just have a pictorial representation of all the different visual effects, because my perception is, I could be wrong here, but my perception is that one of the things that people like about these consumer or these hobbyist video editing applications are the little effects that you can put on your footage. So I'm just thinking a nice clear representation of all the different effects that you have available to you could be right down there at the bottom. And you can just drag that onto your timeline and use it just pretty much as normal in Blender. It's a pretty simple interface. And you can always get, the effects in Blender are pretty much already there. There's a link. I'll try to put in a link maybe to the different effects that you can download straight from Blender.org. So they exist already. It's a thriving, sort of cottage industry, although it's not an industry, but I mean it's, people are writing these effects for Blender, and you can download them and use them. So they're there. They just need to be presented, I think, a little bit more plainly for the home user. And again, I mean the same rules apply here. Don't get bogged down with audio editing tools. Make the export very, very simple. Probably, a lot simpler than what we would give the pro version. And again, not to restrain people, just to make it simple for them, because chances are they're only going to have one of like three different output that they really want to do. They want to either go out to a movie that they can have on their hard drive, or to a DVD, or to the web. I mean, that's what else are they going to do? That's probably what they're going to do with it. So, just give them those options. I think that's about it. That's take a look at it. Give me feedback if you have any thoughts on this. If you're either a professional editor or you're a home user and you see something that I've missed or you question something that I have taken for granted or something like that, let me know. I'm very open to suggestions, and my goal here is to work with Blender developers and possibly get something like this actually done. Not possibly. Get something like this done. This would be a cool thing to have. I know that I would appreciate the pro version a lot because I really want to have a good pro editor for Linux. And I think honestly that a good video editor based on Blender code would just blow Avid and Final Cut out of the water on their native platforms even. That's the great advantage of Blender. It's out there for everything. It could be set up literally to blow those things just out of the water, and it would be really cool because it's free software and people would have a hard time arguing with it. And yeah, they would argue with it because they would immediately, just like Photoshop veterans, complain about GIMP because they don't understand how something's done and they want it to be exactly like Photoshop. People are going to complain about Blender and how it's different, but you and I will know the truth, and that is that Blender is going to be more robust, more flexible, and probably more stable than any of those other applications are ever going to be. So that makes them better, and they're free, so that we can have confidence in their longevity, rather than, the proprietary solutions that are Avid and Final Cut and all those others. So there you go. That's what I've been working on. Hope you like it. I don't know about you, but it sounds like it's time for a coffee break to me. Let's go get some coffee, shall we? Okay, so I got a little bit of feedback, a little bit of listener feedback. And yet I cannot find any of the email that I thought I got. So I know I had some, but I for the life of me, I have no idea where it is. I thought I even like put a little star by it, but apparently not. But yeah, people were talking about video about Blender, saying that they didn't even realize that, you know, Blender could edit video, and so thanks a lot for the tutorials. So I say you're welcome to all of them. Other people said that they like the tutorials, so I'm gonna keep trying to do some form of tutorial, you know, every now and again. I guess what I'm saying is I'm not going to change anything. I'm gonna keep doing what I'm doing, but it certainly is quite nice to be able to elucidate some of the things that people don't know how to use. Tutorials, I think, are great. They're part of documentation. I don't think that any software, free or proprietary, is worth really anything if people don't know how to use it. And I think technology isn't worth a whole lot either if people don't use it. So it's good. I like doing tutorials, so I'll keep doing that. Now, this actually makes me think, since I don't know where my listener feedback is, if I even had any, this makes me think of something that the Linux cranks have been debating hotly lately, which is called Splashtop. And if you heard the last episode, if you don't know what Linux Cranks is, you probably do. You're probably listening to this because you heard me on Linux Cranks. It's linuxcranks.info. It's a discussion sort of ridiculous podcast every Saturday night, way too late, with way too many people on it who don't know what they're talking about. Now, aside from that, there's a lot of times very good discussions on there, and one of the things that they've been discussing, we've been discussing, is Splashtop. Splashtop is the embedded Linux partition, if you will, that people can boot into in, you know, around 3 seconds, because it's all on a boot ROM chip. I mean, it's super fast. You can opt to go into this environment, so you can surf the web and use Skype and things like that. And the idea is, I guess, that, like, Asus specifically, they've got a motherboard with Splashtop on it, and it's this little self-contained environment. You can write your preferences out to a USB thumb drive, so, you know, you can bookmark things in your browser and still get to keep the bookmarks and things like that. But so you can write to hard drives depending on, you know, what you want to do. Or you can just keep it entirely on the chip and not ever, you know, it can just be this sort of disposable environment. You know, you go in, you can check stuff. I don't suppose there'd be any need to clear your history or anything like that, because it's not writing it to anywhere. So it's just kind of a really nice temporary, almost like a live CD or something, except it's really fast, which sounds great to me. To the cranks, however, nothing is just great. It always has to be controversial, and so is Splashtop. So people are asking, well, is this any good? Is anyone ever going to use it? What's the point? You know, people won't ever use this. They'll boot into this. They'll freak out. They'll go back to Windows, etc., etc. And this is all true. But there are a couple of important points to consider here, and since I don't have any of the cranks here to argue with me, this is a perfect time for me to relate them to you. The points that I think we should remember are that technology does not always come with the agreement of everyone using it. You know, people are all the time complaining about how such and such is clunky and not as good as it used to be, blah blah blah, and then the next thing you know, they can't live without it. So, I mean, Splashtop is a fantastic idea. It's a great idea, and yes, certain people may not use it for a very long time. Yeah, geeks are going to be the ones using this, if anyone's going to, and that's normal. Technology is usually adopted by geeks. That's why they're geeks. They are the early adopters. They take the crazy ideas that technologists come up with and program and put onto some device, they use it, and eventually it catches on if it's any good. Geeks are the first line of defense in the technology world. We are the people who use the stuff and figure out if it's actually worth anything. And frankly, I just can't see how embedded Linux is going to be a bad thing. I mean, someone's going to use it. I have a feeling that if geeks use it, they're going to like it. And And if they like it, it's going to improve. You know, they're going to find the bugs. They're going to find the things that, well, this is stupid. This is too hard to set up. You know, it needs this tool. It needs that tool. I mean, these are going to, this is going to develop if we let it, you know. It's just a really good idea. And it's also kind of, it feels to me like it is hearkening toward the idea of less permanent computers, as it were. And I'm really hesitating to say something like cloud computing, because I don't much care for cloud computing, to be honest, but at least not as it is right now. But, you know, the idea that we all have one computer that we go out and purchase and we love dearly is becoming, at least in my eyes, it's becoming a little bit more flexible. It's becoming less certain that that's how you're going to feel about your computer. I mean, a lot of people, you know, in colleges and things like that, I mean, they've got their USB thumb drive in their pocket, and that's it. That's their computer. They go to the college library to use the computers and to write their papers and to print their stuff. But really, their environment is all on that USB thumb drive. And now, you're going to tell me that it doesn't make sense to come up with some kind of environment, Linux-based, which would do exactly what the Unix theory is supposed to do, and that is to say, okay, this is portable. Take your thumb drive. You can either have your own OS on it or not. You could just have your home directory on it. Pop it into the computer, and there you are. There's your computing experience. And all your data is being saved back to your thumb drive. All your little bookmarks and your preferences are being saved to that. So you're basically just carrying around your home directory. I'm not saying that is what Splashtop is, but I am saying is that possibly that is more where computing is going, rather than saying, okay, now carry around your laptop all the time. Or at least it could be going in that direction. And I think that cloud, the whole, you know, the mythical cloud computing idea is an extension of that idea. The difference there is that the cloud has your data, not you. If you don't know who owns the cloud, you don't really know who owns your data. So there's that sort of cautionary word of warning. But, you know, there is that idea of, I guess, less emphasis on owning the computer, and just kind of owning your own sort of environment or your workspace. And, you know, your data is stored on something other than the physical computer that you are working on, whether that's a thumb drive or a server somewhere or whatever. And Splashtop reminds me of that, because it is kind of the same idea. You know, you've got this image on a chip, and that's what you're using, but everything is going to some separate media, and you know, there's that sense of you don't have to have everything completely, you know, installed on your own media. You can use applications that you don't actually possess on your person. So it's just kind of a new movement of computing, I guess, or maybe it's not so new, but it's definitely something that's coming more and more into the public mind share. And I think that Splashtop is a version of it. It's something that is kind of involved in that whole idea, and I think we should respect that, and we should recognize, you know, again, just a Linux opportunity when we see one. I don't think that Linux is just going to take the world by storm. I don't necessarily think it has to in order to be successful, but, you know, in order to keep it well supported and to make me happier, so that when I sit in front of a computer, it's not necessarily, you know, Windows, although actually that doesn't happen to me at all. But, you know, I mean, it would be nicer to sit in front of a computer somewhere if it was Linux than either a Mac or a PC, so Windows. So so that's the idea, I guess. We should look at these new technologies and these new ideas and see them as progressive, and not just say that they're stupid because we don't see people using it yet. Well, people aren't going to use it yet. That's up to us. And we need to decide if it's any good or worthwhile, and if it is, we should develop it, and if not, we should, I guess, ignore it. But Linux on a chip seems like a good idea to me. Well, I had intended that to be a really short show, and it wasn't. I hope all that sort of made sense to you. I know there was some rambling in there, and there was some technical jargon in there, but I think we had fun, darn it. So, thanks for listening, and I will try to get another episode out before the next 3 weeks, for sure. I think I'm settling into things, getting sort of a rhythm back down, so it ought to be alright. If you need to contact me, it's gort.klaatu@gmail.com. That is gort, G-O-R-T, dot klaatu, K-L-A-A-T-U, @gmail.com. You can also hear me sometimes on HPR, that is hackrepublicradio.org, as well as the Linux Cranks, which is linuxcranks.info. Thank you for listening, and I will see you next time.